Hi everyone, welcome back to Birdwatching. This is a podcast about the cultural impact and legacy of the crow. I meant to put this episode out a week or so ago, but I got a really scratchy throat and it might have been COVID, I have no idea. So either way, my voice is much better off now. It might sound a little different, but just roll with me. But the rest of my house has COVID now, and thankfully everyone is doing great, but I am spending as much time away from everyone in my room as possible, so I figured now is the perfect time to finally get this episode out there. When last we talked to each other, we had just finished up our coverage on the first Crow film, the 1994 Brandon Lee starring, Alex Proyas directed, cultural milestone that is basically the reason you and I are even talking to each other at all right now. Maybe. That's a story for another day. But anyway, we finally have our baseline coverage of the first film and novel out in the world. So for now, we're moving on. But I'm sure we'll come back to it at some point, be it with a guest or with new info or something like that. If you ever feel like something is missing from a birdwatching episode, I'm probably going to get to it later with someone that I really want to talk to about it. Right now, it's really hard to conduct interviews for me, but we will get there down the line. Also, there's a lot more road to cover, so today we're starting our journey down the long and winding road that is The Crow, City of Angels. I hope this isn't too controversial a take this early in the episode, but City of Angels has a really strange and messy history. It started with a surprising amount of care and good intentions, got mangled by a literal criminal, and was strange enough to have a few fans anyway. It's a fascinating story. To be perfectly honest, I am not among the City of Angels few devout fans. There are certain aspects that I think are really neat, and we'll certainly get to that. But overall, I can't say that I love this movie as it currently publicly stands. I'll try to get all of our objective facts in before I do any dunking, and honestly, I don't have the heart to dunk on this movie. I'm not here to dunk on this movie. I've worked on big creative endeavors behind and in front of a camera, on stage and off. And I don't think this movie was set out to fail from the beginning, and I don't think the intentions were bad from the start either. So if you're a huge fan of City of Angels, I will be gentle with your feelings, I promise, even if I don't share them. This movie does have its devout fans, which is so... it's probably the only one you can really say that, as you might be able to imagine. The drop-off in, like, devout fans, I keep using that term, but it's the best one I have, for these movies drops off steadily with each one. I have seen one or two people in my journeys across the internet stick up for the next film in the series, Salvation. I have seen no one stick up for Wicked Prayer, but we'll get there when we get there. The first question that comes to mind for many first-time viewers of City of Angels is, why the fuck is this movie so yellow? This movie is so yellow. I showed it to my brother and he called it the piss filter. I'm sure he's not the first. Let's get into it. As I've mentioned several times in the last few episodes, The Crow made really good money at the box office, partially due to the tragedy of its circumstances, partially because people really fucking liked it. Especially considering how cheaply it was made, even with the added budget money to finish the film, that is tantalizing to producers. And what happens when something makes money at the box office? It gets a sequel. We all know this. There were a few problems with this idea. Number one, Brandon Lee is dead. Allegedly, Brandon had signed on for a trilogy of Crow films somewhere in the production process. There were plans for two other movies that were obviously scrapped without the star. Two, there was no other source material for a new Crow film to be tapped from the comics as of yet. The first new Avatar in the comics wouldn't arrive until 1996, the same year City of Angels would release into theaters. Third, most of the cast and crew from the first film were unwilling to reprise due to all that happened, in particular director Alex Proyas, who was taking an extended break and eventually going to return with Dark City, which we discussed a little bit last time. No director, no star, no well of inspiration already for a roadmap, but the call of the sequel was irresistible for producer Ed Pressman, and eventually, to its own detriment, Miramax. There were several mantles that needed to be taken up for a new Crow movie, including a new Crow. This isn't a bad idea all on its own. The comics have continued this trend for years of a new person becoming the avatar of revenge. There's something poignant in the idea that anyone can seek justice, and personally, I like all the different stories and perspectives lent by all the various avatars of undead revenge. But this was new territory at the time, and Pressman & Co. were looking for a surefire bet to lead a new film. Also, a new writer was necessary. David S. Goyer. You've heard that name. He helped write The Dark Knight and several of DC's current superhero films. Goyer was, ironically enough, also working on Dark City at the same time as he was working on City of Angels. With Proyas' attention elsewhere, Pressman & Co. were looking for a new director as well, and they chose Tim Pope. If you have a favorite music video by The Cure, and mine is Lullaby, Tim Pope directed it. He's pretty much their artistic director for all of their music videos. He was a young up-and-comer with a distinct visual style. We know that story. This was Pope's first full-length film. Production designer Alex McDowell and composer Graham Revell also returned, two of the only creative team members of the first film who came back. So we have a baseline of what we're working with here, so what are the pitches? Where do we go from here? The first pitch, it's Sarah. The little girl from the first film, grown up, is murdered and takes up the mantle of the Crow. This received positive feedback, but ultimately no one was willing to bank on a female-led sequel to The Crow, which is shitty. And I hate them forever for it, just kidding, but like also it would have been good. There was a pitch that took place in 18th century England that involved brothers, a few different kind of relationship dynamics were tossed around, a bunch more with like sibling relationships as opposed to a couple. Eventually we wound up with a father and son story set in a gloomy Los Angeles. That was City of Angels. But we still wanted a connection to the first movie as well. So adult Sarah still makes it into the movie. She's just not the Crow in this one. Here's something that blows my mind every time I run across it in this research. Is City of Angels technically takes place in the future? It is technically a post-apocalyptic future movie. In 1996, this movie was set in the distant year of 2002. This is essentially because the Sarah pitches trickled down into Sarah being the second protagonist of the film, and in order for her to be older, it had to be in the future if she was, like, you know, 12 in 1994. I don't know if she was 12. I'm so sorry. They never say. This is a choice. It doesn't feel that way in the film, but bear it in mind. This movie takes place in the future. Just okay. The next big issue to tackle is finding a lead. This was difficult for many reasons, the first of which was this protagonist for a time in the movie's development literally could have been anyone. But after seeing his performance in Lorraine Margot, European actor Vincent Perez was chosen. Perez was virtually unknown outside of Europe and had a long history in theater and only a few film performances, and this was his first effort in American cinema. He's an ethnically ambiguous-looking guy. He's, like, part French and Swiss and Spanish, and he has kind of an accent. So that's on brand for The Crow, I guess. The cast also started filling out with some other really interesting names. Mia Kirshner was cast as the older Sarah. You might have seen her in The Vampire Diaries or Star Trek Discovery. And most notably to me, she played Elizabeth Short in a Black Dahlia movie, which is A-plus casting. She's perfect for it. Richard Brooks plays the new head of the murderous drug-fueled gang, Judah. He's fantastic in that final episode of Firefly. Every time I see him, I'm like, oh, that is the guy who absolutely nailed it in that last episode. Future Punisher star Thomas Jane is here, amongst other various cult classics, but we'll go comic book for the podcast, you know? And perhaps most notably, Iggy Pop finally appears in a Crow film. Iggy was a huge inspiration to James O'Barr during the original creation of The Crow, especially in terms of the original Eric's physicality. Iggy was offered the role of Fun Boy in the first film, and it was kind of partially based on him, but he had to turn it down due to touring schedules. But he shows up here, and we'll get to this later, but he's honestly one of the best performances in the film. This was also Tui Trang's last role. She was the original Yellow Power Ranger and a super accomplished martial artist who frequently did her own stunts. She passed away in a car accident in 2001, and this was her last on-screen appearance. It's honestly a super interesting cast. I think a lot of these names are very interesting and make for a really multi-textured group of people to bring a new Crow story to life. But you might be asking yourself, where is James O'Barr in all of this anyway? He was super involved with the original film. James was originally tasked with writing up a screenplay for the sequel, but he found it was too much for him. He was still deeply affected by the death of Brandon Lee. He gave his blessing to the new team, but declined to be involved any further in production. Which also it's really important to remember when we're going through all of this information. This was so soon after the first film was released into theaters. Like, the turnaround on this was honestly, especially for something that was delayed and had, like, a lot of, someone died working on this. And it's insane that they were like, let's make another one so quickly. It is so surprising to me that they put this out as quickly as they did, but we'll get there. Ed Pressman, Tim Pope, and others on the production team were dedicated to making something unique that honored the legacy of Brandon's performance, but also scratched that itch for a new Cool Crow movie. They knew that they could potentially have something else really special on their hands that could be more than a one-off powered by an offstage tragedy. So they went to message boards in the early days of the internet, asking fans of the comic and of the first film, often a devout set in my experience. And they did some DIY focus grouping, getting a feel of the room on what people would possibly want out of a new one of these. The consensus was clear. Something new was necessary. Don't bring back Eric. Make it unique. Don't fuck with Brandon Lee's last incredible performance. Just make it different. A distinct thing on its own, leaving the first one in place but giving us something new. So the team got to work. Filming commenced in LA at Front Street Studios, where Alex McDowell and his team created an apocalyptic Los Angeles covered in broken glass and brimming with smoke. I always felt like the set dressing of the first movie leaned more noir than dystopian, but City of Angels absolutely favors the latter. Hell is about to swallow up this dying metropolis any second. Everyone looks like the Dust Bowl era spat them out 3 seconds before they walked on screen, but with enough time for them to get into Molgoth gear. The first movie had a focus on the elements of fire and water, so McDowell and his creative team decided to go for earth and air for this one. What with all the smoke, what with all the dust, what with all the broken glass. Seriously, there's broken glass literally everywhere in this movie. The costuming in this movie also feels, like, fairly over the top. And it leans much more towards the sort of commercialized, mass-produced goth that in the first film helped establish in malls everywhere, and leans into the burgeoning new metal scene that had exploded over the movie's production time. If the first Crow movie coincided perfectly with a brief uprising of industrial music in America, this one absolutely is the heralding of mall goth and new metal. Sarah's wardrobe feels very punk fairy tale and is probably the closest callback to the first movie, but everyone else is almost like cartoonishly made up, which is not a bad thing in these movies. Like, this is not a complaint. Thomas Jane is wearing a Buckwild wig that at one point falls off when he slams his head into a steering wheel in a scene. This was a blooper that was left in because it was too funny to leave out and everyone liked it. My first personal favorite piece of design in this movie is our new Crow coat. Ash's coat was designed from a modified priest's frock and intentionally made to spread like wings when he's on his motorcycle, which is great work, everyone. There's a real sense of just trying new things when I read about the production of this movie. This is a chance to break a lot of people into the mainstream. This was a chance to create a long-running film franchise, but they knew they wanted to be different. Vincent Perez was certainly looking to leave a mark in his first American performance, and he had big shoes to fill, let's not lie. And he was really throwing everything into this performance. He mentions taking inspiration from Jim Morrison and Hamlet. Theater kids will always tell you it's Hamlet. Ash frequently does magic tricks, lending him this sort of wild card energy, largely different from the original Crow. And instead of martial arts prowess, they decided that Ash is more like of a street brawler. I can't really tell on that last one, but it was a choice that they made. Tui Trang, who plays Kali, was kind of given nothing to do in the original script and asked Tim Pope to let her have a fight scene with Vincent Perez. And Pope obliged, and I unironically think that their fight is the best in the movie. You may have noticed that I have not revealed any plot details from this movie yet, and that's because the plot is muddled even in its theatrical release. Harvey Weinstein, noted piece of shit, actual criminal, and hopefully the last time that I have to talk about him on this podcast is today. Harvey held Final Cut privileges for this film, and he wanted something that was low risk, high reward, was definitely going to make him a lot of money, and so he essentially hacked this movie to pieces in an attempt to make it just like the first one. And that's basically like putting the square-shaped City of Angels in a round-shaped hole. It did not work. And there are things that do not make sense. I'm going to do my best to explain the plot of the movie as it is, and then I will tell you how maybe it should have gone. Sarah is now an adult. She lives in LA. She moved away from Detroit and became a tattoo artist. She inexplicably still has Eric and Shelley's cat. I pause it here, as I do every time, that Gabriel the cat is actually God, and this is all his fault. But maybe we'll do an episode on that another time. Anyway, Sarah starts having, like, weird dreams about, like, crow stuff, and it's a weird time. Ash is a mechanic. He is a single father to a kid named Danny. They live in shitty apocalyptic LA. And Danny witnesses a drug deal gone wrong with, like, the vicious street gang that are the villains of the movie. And they're like, hey, we should kill this kid because no one gets to see us commit crimes. And then Ash is like, oh, please don't kill my son. And they kill both of them and dump them off of a pier. So that's the villains of the movie. And that's the inciting incident for Ash to return. Sarah drives down to that pier, what might be a few weeks later. There's no time frame given. It might not even be that long. And she witnesses Ash rise from the waters, returning to life, and takes him back to her apartment. And she's kind of a guide for the crow, which is interesting because the crow is already a guide for the crow. The bird is the guide for the person, but I don't make the rules. Ash wakes up and just freaks out at being alive in an apartment and runs away, and he runs back to his mechanic shop and kind of figures out what happens. Sarah follows him and is like, yeah, you're dead, so, you know, here's what you gotta do. You gotta kill everyone who wronged you, and then you can go back to being dead and be with your kid. And, they sort of justify the crow makeup by having Sarah apply Danny's paints that he uses earlier in the flashbacks as the crow makeup, and inexplicably they don't fill in Ash's lips, so he just has, like, you know, when you're wearing black lipstick, you know, my audience of men, according to my anchor demographics, you know, when you're wearing lipstick and, you eat, like, a really nice slice of pizza and you just have, like, the lip liner on, it looks like that. It looks like he's got a weird mustache. I notice it every time. I'm so sorry. Anyway, they have a really hard time justifying, like, the crow makeup as the stories go on. Back to the story, I apologize. So Ash starts to track down the gang members, and he rides a really cool motorcycle. And the first one is a gang member named Spider Monkey, who's, like, easily the most annoying one. It's like if they killed Skank first from the first movie. Like, maybe they should have. They get the dumbest one out of the way first. It's in a drug warehouse. Ash does a bunch of, like, car tricks and causes some explosions to happen. And then he tracks down Thomas Jane, who is going to a weird, like, peep show strip club where there's, like, girls in booths and you talk to them over the phone and you pay quarters to see them. Very strange. And then so Ash kills Thomas Jane while he's jerking off in, like, a peep show. And one of the cut scenes is Ash pleading with the sex worker to go do something else. And then Iggy Pop shows up at Sarah's tattoo parlor and is like, hey, you gave me a bad tattoo. And it's on, like, his, like, like, below his ribs, but, like, above, like, his stomach. It's supposed to be a crow. Like, it's supposed to be, like, the little crow thing that they find at, like, all the crime scenes. They do a lot of, you know how, like, in the first movie, Eric Draven, like, made the crow out of, like, gas and lit it on fire and it looked really cool, where he left the graffiti on the wall. They do a lot of that, but it gets increasingly more ridiculous in this movie. Iggy Pop has that, like, insignia on, like, his body. And Judah is like, bro, you have a crow on you. You're marked for death. It's very unexplained. And Sarah's like, geez, whatever. And Iggy Pop, like, kind of pulls a gun on her and, like, the kindly tattoo shop owner. And so he's on, like, high alert. But, of course, Ash gets to him and Iggy Pop is the next one to go. And then the gang members put, like, two and two together. It's about to be Dia de Muerte, and there's, like, a big festival going on. Ash ducks into a storefront Catholic church a couple times, and an old lady calls him Santa Muerte. There's a lot of Dia de Muerte stuff, which is not a bad idea. It works for LA too. The gang, specifically Sybil and Judah, Sybil is Judah's magical assistant a la Biling in the first film. She's blind and wears a cool cloak the whole time. They capture Sarah. Ash fights Tui Trang in the best fight scene in the movie. Fight me. They have, there's, again, Kali didn't get much to do in this film, but the fight scene is great. And so they capture Sarah, and Ash is like, geez, I have to go rescue Sarah and complete my, undead mission by killing Judah. And so Deftones shows up in this movie. They play the Dia de Muerte festival that's going on outside the villain's lair. They had not even released their first album yet, but Deftones are there. So, a cool, largely unknown by the broader American public band is playing during the final showdown. That's very reminiscent of the first film. It's a long climb up a tower. So Ash is climbing up, and Sarah is going to be ritualistically executed. I don't know. There's also an orgy going on at this point because this movie is full of weird sex stuff. I'm just gonna gloss past that one. He gets up there, and Judah's like, I'm gonna steal the powers of the crow, and he kind of does, but not really. And then Ash's final attack is to set a bunch of birds on him, and they pluck out his eyes and stuff. And Sarah dies. He does not make it in time for her, but he does fulfill his undead mission and moves on, theoretically. So they're all together in the afterlife, I guess. If you feel like I'm missing things, it's because the movie is missing things. Let's get into the laundry list of stuff that is missing. The biggest thread pulled that unravels this garment is the on and off again decision on Ash and Sarah being in a relationship. There was supposed to be a lot of romantic tension there. There was supposed to be a lot more between them that led to an ending that had to be reshot because if they removed the romance, it made the ending not make any sense. So, yeah, they were originally supposed to be romantically linked, and they decided to not do that. The original ending is Ash basically gets told in a vision by Danny, his kid, that he needs to just kill Judah and get the hell out of Dodge. But Ash wants to stay in the land of the living with Sarah and have a second chance at life because he really loves her, I guess, at this point in the film. And Danny's like, if you do that, you're gonna be damned to walk the earth for all time. You will not get to come back to the land of the living because you will neither be living nor dead. This was the original ending. He doesn't make it to Sarah in time. She dies anyway. And he doesn't fulfill the mission, so he wanders. This is a concept that gets brought up in other pieces of Crow media later. We do see the sort of damned for all time ending in a few different places, but we were gonna see it here first, and we didn't. In an effort to make it more like the first movie, they wanted that sense of catharsis at the end, and it doesn't really work. There are still bits and pieces of Sarah and Ash being a romantic item in this movie, but they are definitely not fleshed out. And they are definitely not, explicit is not the word I want to use, because that makes it sound like I wanted them to, fuck in the movie. That's not what I meant. It is not as obvious. Let's go for that, Let's keep it classy. This movie didn't. Like I said, lots of weird sex stuff in this movie. There's, fetish gear was really in the mainstream, and, an obsession with, the burgeoning BDSM, rave scene, and there's, a lot of it in this film, which kind of ties into Judah's, pain and pleasure, kind of Hellraiser-y fascinations. But, yeah, there's a lot of weird sex stuff. That apartment scene where Sarah first brings Ash back to her apartment and he just wakes up, freaks out, and runs away. What originally happened and makes a lot more sense is Sarah is like, hey, you're dead. And Ash is like, what are you talking about? And she, like, stabs him, and it, like, heals over, as you do when you're the crow, and he, like, freaks out and runs away that way. I don't know why they cut this. It literally only would have served to make the movie make sense. It doesn't have anything to do with the cut romance relationship. Like, yeah, that is one thing that I'm like, why did you cut that? It literally, like, I have no words for the hack job that was done on this movie. I really can't imagine what it must have been like to have been a really hardcore fan of the first Crow movie or the original comic or both, and have this movie come out and you go see it, and maybe you were part of those focus groups, maybe you followed its development, maybe you heard of the intentions of the director and the writer and everyone who were like, hey, we want to make something new and different, and you go see it, and it is a shallow ripoff of the first film. No bones about it. It is what it is. The feeling of betrayal, even, it must have felt really gross. And again, City of Angels absolutely has its defenders, but most critics and fans were pretty mixed, more towards the negative. The film currently holds an 11% critic score on Rotten Tomatoes, but it was number one at the box office its opening weekend and made its budget back. The final gross being $17 million against its $13 million budget, which, if you remember, that's not exactly the high reward that someone like Harvey Weinstein probably wanted. I will say this. City of Angels has its fans, and even has some good moments. And people are really dedicated to finding out what the original version of this movie could have looked like. Someone even made a work print cut of the film that tries to put back in as much of the original vision as possible. And Tim Hope himself complimented this work. There's even a small contingent of people who are campaigning for the Pope cut to be released, a la Zack Snyder's Justice League kerfluffle that was solved later last year. As I said at the top of the episode, I'm not really one of these people. And I'm not sure that the unadulterated and unmeddled with vision of this movie is one I would have completely loved anyway. It's admirable that they wanted to do something so different from the first film. I absolutely love the, like, ideas and efforts and stuff. I completely agree with that philosophy. I think it should be what is done for all Crow sequels. But there's just a lot of stuff that isn't working for me in this movie. As a Shakespeare kid who loves a big choice, I just can't get into Vincent Perez's performance, and the script is really not doing him any favors. All of the dialogue that would flesh this character out is left on the cutting room floor. And on the other hand, I think Sarah is given the least egregious of the material, and Mia Kirshner does an admirable job, but she's still in this movie. And I have a hard time seeing the through line to the little punk kid from the first movie. Granted, there's a backstory about Sarah's mom overdosing, and Sarah herself briefly getting into drugs before packing it up for LA, which might have helped to sell this storyline a little more had it made it into the movie. Again, that's not a bad story. It just doesn't make any sense without it. Everyone else just can't seem to muster up any enthusiasm to be there, or is fighting so hard through his script that is not loving them back. Truthfully, my favorite performance is Iggy Pop's. He's so compelling, that melted candle of a man, and knowing the history of his involvement and influence in The Crow makes it really neat. And yeah, at least he gets it. Thomas Jane is probably a close second in terms of villains, but he gets so little to choose besides jack off and die that it's kind of hard to know exactly what he was going for. I love Richard Brooks as an actor, but he doesn't bring anything, and to me it says a lot that Tui Trang had to beg to get a fight scene for herself put in. So much of this cut that is readily available is incomprehensible that watching it almost feels like seeing a taped up crime scene. I'm recording this in January of 2022, and a couple weeks ago, I went out and saw the new Matrix movie, Matrix Resurrections. As you might have been able to tell by the way I talk on this podcast, I'm a huge fan of the Matrix, and I was really excited for a new one. And it's really interesting. I personally loved Matrix Resurrections. Don't tweet at me. I don't want to argue about it. And what is interesting to me is that it serves as like a reboot, a sequel, and a remake, like all at once. And that makes sense because the Matrix came out like 20 years ago. If not a little more. It's been a little more than 20 years. Unfortunately. I know, that makes me feel old too. But at the same time, 20 years is enough time to be able to say, remember that? Remember that in the movie? City of Angels weirdly does, like, the reboot thing. but it's barely 2 years after the first film. And I think that's a huge reason why it feels so icky. It's already trying to play off of barely solidified nostalgia. Had the music scene changed a lot since The Crow? Of course. Had the fashion scene changed a lot since The Crow? Was the general pop cultural landscape pretty different from 1994 to 1996? Yeah, it was a period of big change. A remake. Beat for beat. It feels very hollow. There is, like I said, the sentimentality had not even solidified on this thing yet. No one was having the nostalgic feelings for The Crow that they do now in 1996. There was no time. This thing was rushed out there so fast. Anyway, I was just thinking about nostalgia and how this movie feels like a nostalgia bait piece that would get made now. But in that way, it was ahead of the curve, like so much of The Crow was. If that makes any sense. I hope that makes sense. This was real off the cuff. But, yes. Very strange timing. Very strange decisions. A mess of a movie.
There are a few things that I, as a fan of this particular series of stories, and a person who just likes telling stories, things I would have been interested to see instead of what this film became. And firstly, and maybe the most obvious, is just have Sarah be the Crow. It's that simple. I'm not even joking. Even with these villains and this setting, that still would have been kick-ass. There's a connection to the old films, but it is something different on all levels. I think what really set this whole thing back is this sort of unwillingness to shit or get off the pot in terms of, sorry to use such a, like, crude metaphor, but, like, there's this reluctance to let the first film go, which is, like, very logical. But it's to the detriment of the movie. And they, for all the claims of wanting to do something different, and I truly believe the intention to do so, it just doesn't happen when you have a character from the last film, when you are constantly referencing the last film. Like, there is already a huge hole in the heart of this movie. And it seems like there's this determination to remember what happened last time, even though it is dragging this thing down. I also think that getting as distinct as possible and absolutely, again, shitting or getting off the pot would have been an even better choice. Getting off the pot, if we're going to continue to use this. Suddenly, the brothers in England in the 1700s pitch sounds a lot cooler. The only super old-timey set Crow story that I can think of is one I haven't read yet, because it's only in French. We'll get there when we get there, but hey, anyone know French? Let me know. A totally new setting and character would have given this movie the means to succeed on its own. But if we were going to go in this direction no matter what, keeping the Ash-Sarah romance honestly would not have pushed my buttons that much, and I don't think it would have bothered too many other folks either. It's clear that it was integral enough to the story that taking it out made it nigh incomprehensible. Personally, I doubt the Pope cut will ever see the light of day. So we have to judge City of Angels from the pieces of it that we do have. And those pieces are disparate and weird, but they are a part of the story of The Crow. It's hard to say how things might have gone in a million different directions. One where Brandon Lee got to stick around and finish that trilogy. One where Pope's vision wasn't just shattered. One where David S. Goyer didn't feel the need to disown this script. I hope this journey through a fractured production process was at least somewhat enlightening into how this particular sausage got made. We'll check in with the crowning accomplishment of this film, its soundtrack, on our next CODA episode. And I don't know that I have a lot of other coverage on City of Angels. It happened, it was strange, and it has a strange legacy. But we'll continue next time. Until then, friends, please stay safe. Thank you for waiting on this episode. COVID did invade my house. But we're all doing okay. I am very lucky. And I hope you guys stay lucky in your lives as well. See you next time.